I can assure you that it's quite a challenging experience to be invited, you know, to share 5 years of research done on the change of the Sabbath. It took me a couple of years to write it out. It takes me 3 months to teach it to my students, and I only have 45 minutes to share it with you. My only advantage today that I have all A-plus students, fine, inquisitive, sharp minds, with a lot of, what shall I say, high IQ, so I think this will facilitate the condensation I'm going to give you. So in Italy, we can make the tomato sauce in 2 ways, starting with the fresh tomato if you have plenty of time. But if you don't have much time, then you buy the puree of tomato. You know what I mean? The concentrated tomato sauce. And today I have to give you the concentrated stuff. And I hope that you don't get an indigestion, okay? By way of introduction, I'd like to bring out that this whole question of the change from Sabbath to Sunday has been a long debated question. If you were to pick up, just for curiosity, a book published over 130 years ago by William Hesse, the history of the, of Sabbath, Sunday, which goes from the Reformation to his time, 1860, he only gives us a listing of all the treatises that were produced in about 450 years. And he lists about 1,000 works that were produced during between Reformation and his own time. And if you were to make a bibliographic listing of what has been published from 1860 to our days, I wouldn't be surprised if there's another 1,000 treatises. As far as doctoral dissertation, I can think of about anywhere between 25 to 30 doctoral dissertations that have been produced within the last 30 years. So somebody said that the Sabbath question has had no rest. The Sabbath has had no rest, and perhaps this is a kind of a paradox when we think of the Sabbath rest having no rest, you know? Now, the historical traditional view, as I mentioned earlier, is that the Sabbath was changed to Sunday by the ecclesiastical authority of the Catholic Church. This is the view that we find in Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, where he says the observance of the Lord's Day took the place of the observance of the Sabbath, not by virtue of a biblical precept, but by the institution of the Church. And this has been the view that has been reiterated in all the Catholic catechism until Vatican II. The recent view, however, is that the Sabbath was changed to Sunday not by the authority of the Roman Catholic Church, but by the authority of Christ, by the authority of the Apostle, who, it is claimed, chose the first day of the week in order to commemorate the resurrection of Jesus by means of the Lord's Supper celebration. Let me tell you immediately where I stand, so you know what my view is. In the light of my research, which I'm about to share with you very briefly this morning, the conclusion of my investigation is that this historical change from Sabbath to Sunday came about not by the authority of Christ, not by the authority of the Apostle, not primarily to commemorate the resurrection of Jesus on Sunday, but rather as a result of an interplay of social, pagan, political factor, to which I'm going to allude very quickly, and that led Christians during the reign of this Roman Emperor Hadrian, whose picture appears here in the cover of the Biblical Archaeology Review, which some time ago published my article as the cover story, and the title of the article is How It Came About from Saturday to Sunday. Basically, what I found in my research, that it was during the reign of this Roman Emperor Hadrian, who reigned from 117 to 138 AD, that this historical change began, as you are going to see, because this very emperor in 135 AD promulgated the most repressive anti-Jewish, anti-Sabbath legislation, prohibiting categorically not only the practice of Judaism in general, but of 7 days Sabbath keeping in particular. And we are going to see why all of this happened. But basically, the conclusion of my research that it was in this very critical moment when 7 days Sabbath keeping became difficult, risky, proscribed, forbidden, by Roman imperial legislation that Christians coming from a pagan background, having known and worshipped the Day of the Sun in the pagan day, chose to adopt this Day of the Sun in order to show identification with the pagan Roman and separation from the Jews. Just to give you a gist of where we are leading to. So then now you can follow me a little bit better. Now, what I plan to do, very briefly, I want first of all to examine the two major arguments of Sunday-keeping scholars advanced to justify the change from Sabbath to Sunday. The first argument that we want to examine is the argument of the resurrection, because I'm sure that if you have ever discussed this Sabbath-Sunday question with a Sunday-keeping Christian friend, you have asked him or her, why do they observe Sunday? The natural, immediate answer that you get is what? We observe Sunday in memory or in commemoration of the resurrection of Jesus that took place on the first day of the week. Since this is the prevailing perception, is the prevailing belief, we need to take a moment to examine this whole argument of the resurrection. And this is what I have done in my doctoral dissertation. In the second chapter, you will notice, is devoted to the resurrection and appearances and the origin of Sunday. Now, my investigation, I believe, proves quite conclusively to anyone willing to face the facts that the resurrection indeed was not the predominant motivating factor for changing the Sabbath to Sunday. Let me give you some reasons very quickly. I'm only touching upon them. You can read them in my dissertation if you are so interested. Number one, I find there is no commandment of Jesus, no commandment of the apostles regarding a weekly Sunday or annual Easter Sunday commemoration of the resurrection. We have a commandment for baptism, going to all the world and baptize. We have a commandment for the Lord's Supper. This is doing remembrance of me. A commandment for foot washing. I have given you an example that you may do likewise. But you can read the whole New Testament. You don't find any injunction by Christ or of the apostle regarding a resurrection memorial on a weekly or an annual basis. Number one. Number two, we don't even have the designation, the phrase, Day of the Resurrection in the New Testament. That's very interesting. The day of Christ's resurrection in the New Testament is always denominated Mia Ton Sabbaton, first day of the week. Literally translated is first of the Sabbath, because all the days of the week were numbered with reference to the Sabbath. The term Sabbath, by the way, is also used in a generic way for the week as a whole. And those of you who would like to read the enlightening article in the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, the 7th volume, the first 30 pages by Lawson, he shows that the word Sabbath was Shabbaton, was used for the singular 7-day Sabbath, plural 7-day Sabbath, like Paul for 3 months, or attended the synagogue on the Sabbath, plural. Or it can also, the word Sabbath can mean weekday as a whole, and that's the way I take it in Colossians 2:16, because it has to do with feast, new moons, and Sabbath. You know, the annual, monthly, and weekly days that were observed with certain ascetic prescription. Because the word Shabbatah, Shabbaton, can mean different things depending singular Sabbath, plural Sabbath, or weekday as a whole, because the week was called Shabbatah. That was the name given to the week, and all the days of the week were numbered with reference to the Sabbath. Now, what is interesting, that in the New Testament, we don't even have the phrase Day of the Resurrection. We have to wait until the 4th century, until the writing of Eusebius of Caesarea in his commentary on Psalm 91. This is the day that the Lord has made. He uses for the first time the phrase, Day of the Resurrection. By the way, this gentleman, Francis Regan, who did his dissertation at the Catholic University of America, I had it photocopied and sent it to me to Rome. It cost me a fortune. That's why I remember so much, you know. But he has a chapter on the Day of the Resurrection, and he begins the chapter saying, unfortunately, Sunday is never denominated Day of the Resurrection in the first 3 centuries. Obviously, he was wishing that it would. That could make a good case for this whole resurrection argument, but it's not. And that really goes to show that Sunday, the first day of the week, was not really viewed as a resurrection celebration day, as it later became in Christian history. That was number two. Number three, on the day of his resurrection, Jesus did not invite the women first and the disciple later, when he appeared to them, to come apart and celebrate his resurrection. Don't you think that if Jesus wanted the day of his resurrection to be memorialized, he would have capitalized on that occasion, the day of his resurrection, to institute this resurrection memorial? By the way, have you noticed that all of these biblical institutions, such as the Sabbath, baptism, Lord's Supper, foot washing, they all trace their origin to a divine act which established them? The Sabbath was established with the rest of God. On the seventh day, God finished his work. By the way, it's interesting. I was reading the paper that your church has produced. So senseless. Ooh, sometimes I tell you, I get upset. You know, I fill my waste paper basket every week with all sorts of material. I only read one paragraph, and then one lady was calling me up. What is the name of this guy that is having all of this radio talk show here on the West Coast? He has a book, Sabbath or Sunday, that he argues on Matthew 28, one at the end of the Sabbath when the women went to the sepulchre. He said that that statement is a theological statement, saying that, you know, that was the end of the Jewish Sabbath and the beginning of the Christian Sunday. Have you read this little booklet? And they have sent me 3-4 copies. The people said, why don't you answer this man? Why do you want to answer foolish people? I mean, the Bible says, don't throw pearls to the pigs. And I don't have time to waste for people that don't have common sense. If people have a twisted mind, God forgive them for that. And let's move on and deal with people that have a sensitive mind. What I was trying to say a moment ago, I don't know how I got carried away. That if Jesus wanted the day of his resurrection to be memorialized, he would have capitalized on the occasion to start it. That's how the Sabbath started, with the act of God resting on the Sabbath to mark its beginning for the human family. That's how baptism started, with the baptism of Jesus. That is how the Last Supper started, when Jesus took the elements, you know, of the Passover and used them to institute a memorial of his atoning death. In other words, all this biblical institution traced their origin to a divine act. And we would have expected the same to be true for this resurrection memorial if that had been Christ's intent. Keep that in mind. I feel that is a very compelling argument that you can submit to anyone that is willing to do some thinking. If they are not willing to do some thinking, don't waste your time. If people are so prejudiced, don't waste your time. I don't like to waste time with people that don't want to think. But there are people that want to think, that have an inquiry in mind. The next argument that is used by Rohrdorf is in his dissertation that Sunday was the day in which the Lord's Supper was celebrated, and consequently Sunday became the Lord's Day. He tries to establish this linkage between Kuriakon, Deifnon, Lord's Supper, and Kuriakemera, Lord's Day. And so his argument is that the Lord's Supper was always celebrated on Sunday, and consequently the Sunday became the Lord's Day. Now, I took time to examine all of this claim, and again, I found that it was based on fantasy, not on facts. Because the truth of the matter is that the Lord's Supper in early Christianity, in the earliest day of the Christian church, was not celebrated exclusively and consistently on Sunday. If you read the 1 Corinthians chapter 11, 4 times Paul says, verse 18, 20, 33, 34, when you come together. Which day is that? It's no specific day, it's indefinite. Why is it indefinite? Because there was a Roman legislation prohibiting this evening supper gathering, this evening supper meal, not only for the Christian, but even for the pagan. The firemen in Nicodemus, pleaded with the emperor Trajan through their governor Pliny if they could have a trade guild supper meal in the evening, and the emperor said, no, absolutely not. You start with good intention, but it's not long before your meeting becomes political plotting. So the Christians came under the same heteria jurisdiction, which prohibited any kind of evening, supper, social meal. So what did the Christians do? They changed the time, they changed the place. 1 week, your home, Monday night, 7 o'clock. Next week, your home, Tuesday night, 8 o'clock. By changing the venue of their gathering, they were trying to escape the search of the Roman police. So we have ample documentation that the earliest Christian, when they celebrated the Lord's Supper in the evening because they wanted to keep in the same evening context in which Jesus instituted, they were not having it on the same day. Then eventually what they did, they anticipated in the morning. And we already have references to that in the famous letter of Pliny to Trajan and other document indicating that in order to deal with this all, to what shall I say, not to come in conflict with the Roman legislation, they had to make this change. But basically, originally, there was no a consistent Sunday pattern as Rordolf would like us to believe, number one. Number two, what about the meaning of the Lord's Supper? Does Paul suggest, for example, or do the early Christian documents suggest that the Lord's Supper was seen as a resurrection celebration? I'm afraid not. What does Paul say? That when you partake of the wine and you drink the... I'm sorry, when you partake of the bread and drink the wine, you proclaim what? What do we proclaim? The Lord's death. It is the death, the passion and the parousia till he comes. There is no resurrection motif present. And I could develop this, but we don't have time for that. The next point I like to make, which discredits this whole argument of the resurrection, is the dating of the Passover. Today, most Christians observe Passover on Easter Sunday. By the way, Easter is not a biblical name. You don't find Easter in the Greek New Testament, even though you find it translated there sometimes in the King James. But that is a mistranslation, because the Greek is Pascha, which means what? Passover. And when did the early Christians celebrate Passover? Did they celebrate it on Easter Sunday like today? Absolutely not. We have abundant evidences, particularly if you study all the Passover controversy, known as the Quartodeciman controversy of the second century, that became one of the dominant controversies in the Christian church. By the way, I'm a church historian. My PhD is in church history, and I worked on this material. I chewed on it for many years while I was over there. So I hope that you take what I say with a degree of confidence, because if you ask me questions on many areas, I will admit my ignorance. But on this area, this was my daily bread, you know, while I was there for those 5 years at the Vatican. So I have chewed on it. And the interesting thing is that in the last part of the second century, there was a big debate over the dating of the Passover. There was the apostolic tradition, which was holding to the Nisan 14, to the biblical dating of observing Passover on the 14th day of the first month. And then there was the Roman tradition, the Church of Rome, which was trying to persuade the rest of the Christian world to adopt Easter Sunday. But the Eastern Christians were not prepared to do so. And Polycrates, with all the bishops there of Asia Minor, the red, the papal summon, the papal document, they send it back, say, no, you can have it, we are not prepared to change. And Bishop Victor in 186 excommunicated all of them for refusing to adopt the Easter Sunday custom. What is the point I'm trying to make? Is that if the early Christians had, you know, come up with this whole idea that they needed to celebrate the resurrection on a weekly and annual, on a weekly Sunday, an annual Easter Sunday, we would also have not only the weekly Sunday resurrection celebration, but even the annual Easter Sunday, should be able to trace it to the very beginning of the Apostolic Church. But the truth of the matter, that the earliest trace of it comes from the second century, from Bishop Sixtus, 125, which is the Hadrian period, as we are going to see. Well, there is more to be said, but I'll just leave it at that. Some of these points, I think, should help to make the case that the resurrection per se was not the motivating factor for changing the Sabbath to Sunday. Now, the next question is, who did it? If you were to read some of the recent research that has been published, you will find that a tremendous effort is being made to make the Jerusalem Church the birthplace of Sunday keeping, to make the apostolic authority residing in the Jerusalem Church as the pioneer of the abandonment of the Sabbath and the adoption of Sunday. That argument is based on a number of presuppositions. The first presupposition, perhaps, is that only a church that commanded sufficient authority to influence the rest of Christendom could dare to change a deeply rooted millenarian institution such as the Sabbath and introduce a new day of rest and worship. So, and then the question is, which was the headquarter? Where did the apostolic authority reside? Who enjoyed, who commanded such an authority? Obviously, it was the Jerusalem church. If a minor, smaller church would have endeavored to introduce a new day of rest and worship, they would have had such a resistance, such a opposition. And this leads to the second presupposition. If Paul had done it, if Paul had been responsible for introducing Sunday keeping, for, you know, pioneering the abandonment of the Sabbath and the adoption of Sunday, he would have had no end of problem with the Jerusalem brethren. Do you remember what it happened regarding to the circumcision? We are told that the men of James were following Paul like a shadow. Just they wanted to be sure that he would not teach the Jewish converts to give up circumcision, you know, which he never did. However, they still accused him of being a renegade of the law because supposedly they were fabricating that nonsense that he was teaching, you know, the Jewish converts, you know, not to practice circumcision anymore, which is not true. But if he had dared to promote the abandonment of the Sabbath, we would have an echo of the controversy in the New Testament document, which we don't have. So the silence suggests to the scholars that it was the Jerusalem church that took the initiative to abandon the Sabbath and to adopt Sunday keeping. And Paul accepted this change as taught him by the Jerusalem brethren. And then when he went among the Gentiles, he taught them Sunday keeping because that's what he had been instructed to do by the leadership of the Jerusalem church. And then they say that after all, Jesus resurrected there in Jerusalem. He appeared there in Jerusalem. And it was in the Jerusalem church that the need was felt immediately. As soon as Jesus ascended to heaven, they found themselves, this Christian community, they found themselves out of place in the synagogue. They went to the synagogue, yes, but they felt like fishes out of water. They felt that was no longer the place they could worship. So they needed a new place. So they went across the street. They must have rented a room or some kind, or perhaps one of the believers opened up the room, opened up their home, so they had this home church. And then they needed not only a new place, but they needed also a new day to give expression to their new faith in the risen Savior. So basically, these are some of the reasoning which are presented to make the Jerusalem church the birthplace of Sunday keeping. Dear friends of the Sabbath, let me tell you, I've taken time to examine all of this nonsense, this hogwash. You know, I tell you sometimes, the longer I live, and the more I find that common sense is the most uncommon thing in the world. Really. And sometimes people feel that I'm a little bit more abrasive, but too much abrasive. But you know what? If some of these people did not have access to literature, which shows the continuity, like Professor Nathan was helping us this morning, very enlightening presentation, and the man knows what he's talking about. I tell you, I always respect people, even if they disagree with me, no problem. Like these people that have written this book, you know, they quote me 200 times, many times they disagree with me, but I respect them as scholars because they use common sense. And when people don't use common sense, then I don't have any respect for them. When their mind is twisted, that's too bad. You know, it's no use to work with them. Now, I like to propose to you to read my chapter on the Jerusalem church and the origin of Sunday. What I have done, dear friends, I have spent considerable time to understand the Jerusalem church, to understand its ethnic composition, to understand its theological orientation. I spent many months reading all what I could find about the early history of the Jerusalem church. I wanted to find out what kind of church was it. Was it a Judeo-Christian church or a Gentile church? Was it a church deeply committed to uphold Jewish religious practices in general and Sabbath keeping in particular? Was it a church which was predominantly Gentile that broke away early, immediately, as some of these scholars would like us to believe, you know, from Judaism and initiated a new day and a new form of worship? So I spent a lot of time studying it. And if you read my analysis, you will find there's no question about it, that the Jerusalem churches of all churches was, number one, composed of former Jews, we call them Judeo-Christians, who were deeply loyal, committed to the observance of God's law in general, and of the seventh-day Sabbath in particular. I could give you a mountain of proofs and documentation, but time is running so fast and I have so much to cover, so I only hint a few little things. Let me just mention, for example, the Jerusalem Council of Acts 15. Are you familiar with Acts 15, the Jerusalem Council that was held in the year 49? Some of you are smiling. Apparently you must have heard about it. You know, shall I tell you what? Some scholars said that was the watershed. Have you ever heard that? That was the breaking point when the leader of the Jerusalem church not only released the Gentiles from circumcision, but from the whole Mosaic law, including the Sabbath. Have you ever heard that? Oh man, nothing could be farther from the truth. There is no question that the Gentiles were exempted from the circumcision. But that was not against the Mosaic legislation. In fact, if you read the document carefully, you will find that the whole resolution of the Jerusalem Council is based on the Mosaic legislation of Leviticus 17 and 18. By the way, I'm not the one making this comment for the first time. There's an excellent book by Jacob Gervais, Luke and the People of God, a series of lectures delivered of all places at Harvard University. 10 lectures. And that book will open your eyes. And this professor, who is a Swedish scholar, by the way, clearly shows that Luke is concerned to show how the Jerusalem church was most loyal, respectful of the Mosaic law and teaching and practices. In fact, what the Jerusalem Council did was to apply to the Gentiles the Mosaic legislation which applied to the ge'er, to the alien, to the stranger. Moses established that an alien, a stranger, could join the community of Israel without being circumcised, but they had to observe four regulations, four prerequisites, which included the abstention from pollution of idol, that is, contact or with idols, you know, eating perhaps food consecrated to idol. It could imply more than one thing. Number two, they were to abstain from strangled meat, because that was very important for the Jewish people. In the Old Testament Mosaic legislation, the animal that was used for human consumption, that meat, the blood had to be drained for both theologically and the medical reason. Theologically, because the blood was the symbol of life. Medically, because the blood contains all the viruses, all the infection. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of the major reasons why so many Americans have to spend so much money on medical bills, it's because when they go to this fast food, they often buy the steak or whatever hamburger they give, this patties, whatever. And you notice inside there's still blood many times. It's not even properly cooked. And so they are ingesting all the germs. And then they have to run to the doctor to get antibiotics. And you know, the Jewish people were a healthy nation. God gave them good hygienic laws. One lady was asking yesterday, why should a woman with a period, you know, have this quarantine and so forth? Again, because they did not have the shower in their home where they could wash themselves twice a day. So if you had some fluid in your body, you better stay away. And so you're spreading germs. You follow me? This Mosaic legislation was not foolish, as many people think. There was a lot of wisdom in it. God wanted the Israelites to be a prosperous and healthy nation. At any rate, you will find that these four prerequisites, this pollution of idols, strangled meat, blood and porneia, fornication, they are all found there in Leviticus 17 and 18. So basically what the Jerusalem Council does, applies the Mosaic legislation to the Gentiles. And I want you to notice that the court of appeal, the final court of appeal for James first and for the council later, is Moses. Acts 15:21, what did it say? For Moses is read every Sabbath in the synagogue. Consequently, we want to be sure that we follow his directives. You follow me? If you look at the passage with common sense, some people don't have common sense. If you don't have it, don't waste your time with them. Just leave them alone. Leave them. I don't want to waste time with people that cannot think. But if you deal with a person that is willing to look at the document for what it says, he will see right away that if anything, this Jerusalem Council shows tremendous respect for the authority of Moses. And this comes out even clearly a few chapters later on Acts 21. Paul's last visit to Jerusalem. He had gathered all of this money from the Gentiles, was bringing it to the poor people there in Jerusalem, to these poor Christians that were going through a famine, and you remember, started telling to James all the great things that the Lord had done through his ministry among the Gentiles, and James and the elder listened. But then they said, hey, listen, Paul, listen, we want you to know that we were not on vacation. We have been busy too, fulfilling our ministry. And you see, Brother Paul, Acts 21:20, powerful text. You see, Brother Paul, how many myriads in the original there are of the Jews who have believed. And they are what? They are all zealous for what? For the law. I went to show this text to my professor. My strategy was to show him anything significant that I was finding. My strategy was to chip at him a little bit at a time. I didn't want to give him a shock treatment at the end. So whenever I came out with a good text and a good document, I always rushed to his room. So I said, Professor Monachino, have you seen what it says? This is, we are about 58 AD, almost 30 years after the death of Jesus. We are told that the thousands, the myriads of Jews that believed, they were all zealous in the observance. They were so zealous that they even proposed to Paul to do something. You remember what he said? Hey, you came here for the Feast of Pentecost, and they know that you are here. There's a lot of people coming in from the diaspora, from the dispersion. If they know that you are here, the rumor was circulating that Paul was the renegade of the law, you know, teaching the Jews to forget about more. If they know that you are here, they're going to make a sausage out of you. So if you want to save your neck and save your skin, why don't you go to the temple? Why don't you participate in a purificatory rite? And this is what Paul did. He even paid for other people. Why? Acts 21:24. So that everybody will see that you also, Paul, are not the renegade of the law, but you live in accordance, in obedience to the law. So what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to reconstruct this picture of the Jerusalem church to help you to see that this is not a church that broke away radically and immediately after the resurrection, you know, from Judaism, from the law and from the Sabbath. Let me tell you, dear friends, there is a prevailing misconception which has survived for centuries to this very day. And I'm glad that it's being corrected today. And I think the studies to which Professor Nathan was also referring now a bit earlier about all this rediscovery of this sectarian Judaism is helping a lot. And if you go to the Society of Biblical Literature, I haven't been there now for a couple of years because I was overseas at the time of their meeting, but they have a whole section on Judeo-Christian studies. I presented 5 papers there at the SBL, as we call it. And what pleases, what really delights my heart is that finally they are coming around and they are recognizing that Christianity did not begin as a radical breakaway from Judaism. In other words, the prevailing misconception in the past has been that the cross is the line of demarcation. Before the cross, you have Judaism, the law, and the Sabbath. After the cross, you have Christianity, grace, and Sunday keeping. Have you ever heard this construct? Eh? This is one of the greatest fallacies that has been perpetrated in the history of Christianity. The truth of the matter is that those earliest believers, the 3,000,
who believed on the day of Pentecost, the 5,000, the thousands of thousands, if you had asked them, who are you? What would they have said? I'm a Christian? Absolutely not. They didn't even know what that term meant. The term Christians was coined later on by the Romans in Antioch, as you recall, because they heard all of these people talking about Christos, Christos, so the nickname Christian, who are you? They would have said, I'm a believing Jew. What did they believe? They believed that Jesus of Nazareth was their expected Messiah. And by accepting Jesus of Nazareth as their expected Messiah, they were not changing religion. They were still Jews. They were believing Jews. And this is what Jacob Gervais brings out in his book, Luke and the People of God. He brings out that the conflict in the book of Acts is between believing and unbelieving Jews. And so basically, that's why you could baptize them by the thousands. When the gospel went beyond the boundary of Judaism, you could not baptize them on the same day. It took a couple of years, at least a year, to make a convert, to lay down the moral, biblical foundation, because many of these pagan people didn't know the ABC of the Judeo-Christian morality, of lifestyle. And usually the Baptist took place only once a year, at Pentecost or at Easter, you know. They had to establish what they call cathedral schools, you know, baptismal classes to train the pagans. So sometimes people say we need the power of Pentecost, you know. They don't realize that the reason why so many thousands were converted is because there was no need of a radical change of lifestyle. Everything was in place. The only thing that they needed was just to accept Jesus. They believed. What? Not the 27 Adventist fundamental beliefs. They didn't even know about them. What they believed is that Jesus of Nazareth was their expected Messiah. Well, I could give you much more on this, but let me just mention one more document. The day when I found this document there in the Patrologia Greca, volume 42, I jumped for joy, because some days when I went there at the Gregoriana, and I had to drive 50 miles, risk a police ticket because there was no parking area, and being able to be there only from 9 to 12 and 3 to 6, because from 12 to 3, everything shut down. I wish we could do that today so we could have a little time for a siesta, you know. But in America, there is no time for siesta. You go right on. Even though we Mediterranean need a little siesta. So if you find me sleeping in this afternoon, you know why. I'm getting my siesta, you know. But anyhow, I went there at the library, everything, spent a lot of money, and then sometimes I couldn't find the thing. Turn the pages, looking in this patrologia, in this patristic literature, and many times it was so hard to find what I was looking for. But I remember the day when I came across this whole section of Epiphanius, a Palestinian historian who writes about 350 AD. He discusses the history of the Jerusalem church, and he tells us that the direct descendant of that church left the city prior to the destruction of AD 70 in accordance to the warning given by Jesus in Matthew 24. You remember how Jesus warned the Christian not to linger in the city when they would see the surrounding Roman army, but to flee. And this is exactly what the Christian did. Where did they go? They went up to a place called Pella. They colonized the place. They became known as the Nazarene, a term that already occurs in Acts of the Apostles, as you know. And you know what Epiphanius tells us about these Nazarenes, who are the direct descendant of the Jerusalem church, is those who are regarded as the Orthodox branch of Jewish Christianity. He tells us that this direct descendant of the Jerusalem church insisted and persisted in the observance of the circumcision and the seven-day Sabbath. When I found that document, I said, man, let me get a copy of it right away. Let me go to show it to my professor. That was my strategy. Just give him something to think about. As soon as I found something that was worth thinking about. So I asked the monk, hey, can you make a copy of this? Ooh, you know the policy. Leave it here with me today. You get the copy of it tomorrow. They are not in a hurry. They have been around 2,000 years. One day more, one day less. Doesn't make any difference. But when you are excited, you cannot wait for 24 hours. At least I couldn't. So I gave him a little tip. I pulled out, not dollars, just some few thousand lira. I put them in his hand. I said, please, accept this as a token expression of gratitude for your immediate service. And like in the creation story, it spoke and it came into existence. A minute later, I had the document. It was hot out of the copy machine, hot in content. I went to show it to my professor. Professor Monachino, he was in his room. Have you seen this document? What did you find? Why don't you take a look at it? It was bilingual, Latin and Greek. He read the Latin because it's very easy for us Italians to read Latin. It's just like Italian, almost. But where did you find this? Dove l'hai trovato? Where did you find it? Well, it was right here. I did not bring it from America. And then he read the Greek column. And I remember when he said, questo è il certificato di morte. This is the death certificate, the death blow, the death nail to the theory which makes Jerusalem the birthplace of Sunday keeping. Why did he say that? Because he was a sharp guy. You don't become a Jesuit if you have a low IQ. There is no room for idiots among the Jesuits. Believe me. The only problem, they expect a lot out of you. They expect you to be as sharp as they are, and that sometimes puts you on the alert all the time. He caught the point right away. He caught the point that if the direct descendant of the Jerusalem church insisted and persisted in the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath, then what? Then they could have hardly been responsible. They could have hardly, pioneered the abandonment of the Sabbath and the adoption of Sunday when they were still observing the Sabbath in the fourth century. You get it? You don't? You get it. So you must have some Jesuit blood. Good for you. Having been able to prove to the satisfaction of my professor that Jerusalem was to be excluded as the birthplace of Sunday keeping, my last challenge was to find the place, the time, the causes, and the consequences. And I noticed I only got 2 minutes to 1:45. How can I share all of that in 2 minutes? It's out of the question. But let me just make a statement. We might be able to discuss it in some of this panel discussion. Basically, what I found, as I continue my investigation, I found cumulative evidences pointing to the Church of Rome and to the authority of the Bishop of Rome, who became known as the Pope, as the one responsible for leading Christians away from Sabbath keeping into Sunday keeping. When did this change begin? Approximately in the year 135 AD. That was the year when this Roman Emperor Hadrian promulgated the most repressive anti-Jewish, anti-Sabbath legislation. Why? Because the Jewish people were going through a resurgent feeling of nationalism. They were experiencing this heightened messianic expectation. Between 60 to 135 AD, you find that the Jewish people were in constant uprising, revolt in Egypt, Cyrenaica, Asia Minor, Palestine, the AD 70, first Jewish war that killed about 500,000 Jews, another 500,000 taken to Rome as prisoner according to Josephus. And then we have the second Jewish war, known as the Bar Kokhba revolt, from 132 to 135. It was a bloody war. The Romans suffered tremendous casualties. Hadrian had to bring in his Roman legion from Gaul, from France, in order to strengthen his army. Why? Because the Jewish people were fighting a guerrilla warfare, coming down at night from the valley, from the mountains, attacking the rear guard, slaughtering as many Roman soldiers as possible, then fleeing like the Americans in South Vietnam. That's why the Americans got in a quagmire and finally they got out of it because they noticed it was a no-win situation. And the Romans had suffered tremendous casualty. We know it from the correspondence between the emperor and the Senate in Rome. But finally, when he succeeded in taking Jerusalem, in 135 AD, he said, this is it. Hadrian said, this is it. Hitler said, let's liquidate the Jews. Hadrian, whose name also begins with an H, by the way, said, let's liquidate Judaism as a religion. So he felt the only way to deal with the Jewish problem is to abolish the Jewish religion. So he promulgated a very repressive anti-Jewish legislation prohibiting the practice of Judaism in general and of 7 days Sabbath keeping in particular. When I found all of this legislation, I asked myself the question, how did this Hadrianic imperial anti-Sabbath legislation affect the Christians. Christians, particularly who were living in Rome, felt that the best policy to adopt was to show to the Romans their separation from the Jews and their identification with the Romans. How? By changing the Sabbath to Sunday and Passover to Easter Sunday. And I found that the Church of Rome, which became later on, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, at this stage is in an embryonic stage, but eventually becomes known as the Roman Catholic Church, played a very important role in leading Christians away from seven-day Sabbath keeping. If you read the sixth chapter of my dissertation, I have a lot of these papal decretals, which I'm quoting. Some people find it a little bit slow reading because half of every page is footnote apparatus, which unfortunately is needed to give documentation. You see, I was writing this dissertation not for the lay people. I knew that I had to defend my dissertation before a team of Jesuit scholars who were not satisfied with generalities, you know, with general statements. They wanted to have a clear document and argument for any statement that I made. That's why some people get a bit overwhelmed with this book. But I must apologize, but it was not meant to be for the lay person. When you write a doctoral dissertation, you have to have certain scientific criteria that you have to follow. But I found a lot of documents which really help us understand the methods used by the Church of Rome to lead Christians away from Sabbath keeping to Sunday keeping. Theologically, I found that the Sabbath was interpreted to be not a covenant sign, not a creational, universal institution, but rather, as Justin Martyr says in 150, writing from Rome, as a trademark of Jewish depravity. Says, you Jewish people are a murderous people. You have murdered the prophet. You have murdered Christ. You deserve to be punished. And God has put on you the trademark of your depravity in the Sabbath. The Romans only need to find out who keeps the Sabbath, and they know who are the people that deserve punishment, because the Sabbath is the trademark of your depravity. I tell you, I was shocked. I was shocked when I read all of this, what I call in my dissertation, theology of contempt. What is shocking me is not only what some of these authors say, but what is shocking me is that the scholarly community have never shown their shock about Christian leaders, you know, who dare to make the Sabbath the sign of human depravity and wickedness. Any Christian scholars who has any familiarity with the Scripture knows that in the Old Testament the Sabbath is given as a covenant sign between you and me throughout your generation, that you might know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. And the word there, lekadesh, that means is the term used for the engagement of a woman to a man. So the lekadesh, that sanctify in the sense that I take you as my, so to speak, as I take you as my bride. I'm the one that sanctify you by manifesting my presence, my blessing upon you. So it is a sign of covenant commitment. It's a sign of divine blessing, and yet it is interpreted to be a sign of human depravity. Shall I tell you, it is this theology of contempt that begins there with Barnabas in 135, you find it in Justin Martyr, in Irenaeus, in Tertullian, throughout history. This is the red thread that leads to the Holocaust, to Hitler. You may not realize, but Christians have a lot of explaining to do of how they have been able to maintain a consistent policy of anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. And as you go through history, you find all of these councils, ecclesiastical council telling the Jews to wear their Star of David on the front, to stay inside during the Passover week, not to have any civil offices. You know, the Jewish people know their history better than we Christians do. And there are a lot of informed Jews who have great difficulty to accept Christianity because they know about this theology of contempt that has been perpetrated throughout the century and has prepared the climate for the extermination of the Jews during the Nazi period. Because once you start teaching people that the Jewish people have committed the crime of deicide, of having murdered God, that they are a murderous people, then why don't you murder them as well? You follow me? It doesn't take very long, you know, to poison the mind of people, of Christians, against the Jews. Well, what the Roman Church did, number one, was to change the Sabbath from a universal divine institution given to the world to a Jewish institution as given to the Jewish only as a trademark of their depravity. Number two, I found that what the Church of Rome did, what some of distinguished popes like Sylvester, Innocent I, and so forth, what they did, was to change the Sabbath from a day of feasting into a day of fasting. For the early Christians and for the Jews, the Sabbath was a day of feasting and joy. The best food, the best clothing, the best perfume, the best oil for the lambs, everything was reserved for the Sabbath. Sabbath was a day of delight. They tried even to create a delightful atmosphere in their home. But I found that in order to kill the festive gleam of the Sabbath, the papacy decreed that the Sabbath should be a day of fasting rather than feasting. And why? Well, you read there, for example, Pope Sylvester, who says, in 313, he says, in order to show exacratione judeorum, hate, execration, contempt toward the Jews and toward their Sabbath. And consequently, in order to predispose Christians to longingly wait for Sunday to come. How would you like to spend the Sabbath with an empty stomach? My children wouldn't like it. They will be crying all the time, Mama, Papa, when is the Sabbath over so that we can grab the pizza? Because my wife makes two big pizza on Friday night, and usually she makes an extra one for Saturday night. Now, the Jewish people had the two loaf of bread, the halot, you know. We are not Jewish, we are Italian, so we have the two pizzas, you know. During the week, we sometimes eat the frozen pizza, which is like straw. But for Friday night, my wife goes into the trouble to prepare some nice, fresh pizza with fresh dough, the good sauce. And I tell you, we really enjoy starting the Sabbath with a good pizza. It gives some more gusto to the Sabbath. You know what I mean? And if I was to tell my kids that now they had to spend the Sabbath without eating any food, they would be longing to see the end of the Sabbath so that they could grab the other pizza, put it in the oven, and share it with their friend. That's when the gang comes over. So socially, I found that the Church of Rome tried to kill the festive gleam of the Sabbath by changing the Sabbath from a day of feasting to a day of fasting. So whenever you see a person that has a very gloomy outlook on the Sabbath, a long face, very sad, tell them right away that they are following the dictates of the Church of Rome and not the principle of the Scripture. Because the Bible tells us the Sabbath should be a day of delight, day of joy. But if people find the Sabbath to be a frustration, a day of gloom, a day of sadness, then they are doing exactly what the Pope said that Christians who hated the Sabbath should do, to have a long face. Okay? And liturgically, I found that the Bishop of Rome prohibited all sorts of any kind of Sabbath gathering. Now, there is much more to be said, but the time is running away. Let's see if I can just touch on the last question. Tell you asked me to do the impossible. Believe me, to cover all of this research in 45 minutes. Usually when I give my weekend seminar, I have about an hour and a half, 2 hours. That gives me more room to play, more time to play with. But there's one question we have to touch very, very quickly, because otherwise I would leave my presentation very incomplete. The question is, why was Sunday chosen? If this separation from the Jews was the motivating factor for the abandonment of the Sabbath and the adoption of another day, why did they come upon the choice of the Dies Solis, or the Day of the Sun, Sunday? I found a very important reason was the popularity of the sun god with its sun day. To make it very brief, I found as far as the sun worship
It went through two different stages. The first stage, in the first century, the Romans had their native sun worship. When we come to the second century, we have the imported Eastern sun worship of Mithraism, Sol Invictus Elogabal, so there is a syncretistic sun worship. And what happened? What happened is that this popularity of the sun worship, of the sun god, caused a change in the planetary week. Now, I don't know if you're aware of it, but the Romans did not have a seven-day week until the beginning of Christianity. They had an eight-day week, Nundinum. But just before the beginning of Christianity, the earliest archaeological evidence go back to about 32 BC, they adopted the seven-day week because of the influence of the Jews scattered in the diaspora that were influencing the Romans to adopt the seven-day week and so forth. But when the Romans adopted the seven-day week in the first century, this is one of the archaeological calendars, it's interesting that the first day of the seven-day week was Saturni, the second day was Solis, the third day was Lune, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, this was a peg calendar. They would put a little peg to indicate the day of the week, a peg to indicate the day of the month, 1, 2, 3, 4, a peg to indicate the marketplace. Now, what was interesting, that in the first century, when the Romans adopted the seven-day week, they made Saturday as the day number one. For the Jews and for the Christian, it was day number seven. But for the Romans, to make it important, it had to be number one. For the Jews, to make it perfect and complete, and for the Christian, it had to be number seven, because that is the meaning of seven. But what happens? Why was Saturni the first day? Because in that time, the Saturn god was the most important god. But by the time we come to the second century, when the sun god emerges as the first and most important god of the Roman pantheon, what do we find? That Solis, the day of the sun, which had been day number two, was promoted and advanced to the position of day number one. When I discovered this in my research, this advancement of the day of the sun from day number two in the first century to day number one in the second century, I asked myself the question, is it possible that in this very moment when the Romans advanced the day of the sun to the first and most important day of the week, and when the Christians had the necessity of choosing a different day to show their separation from the Jews and their association with the Romans, it is possible that the Christians came upon the idea of choosing the self same of the day of the sun, which was being promoted, advanced in the Roman society, and that's exactly what happened. And I think I've been able to prove it quite convincingly by using both indirect and direct evidences. Indirectly, I found that sun worship influenced Christianity in a variety of ways. It influenced Christianity in art. It's interesting how all the picture of the sun god was used to portray Jesus. I made a whole trip to Rome to get a good picture of this mosaic of Jesus as the sun god that was recently discovered under excavated under the Confession of St. Peter, right there in the Basilica of St. Peter, where Jesus is portrayed as the sun god with all the shaft of light, riding the quadriga chariot. This is basically Mithra. It's the Sol Invicto Elogab, and yet they use it to portray Jesus, because this is a Christian chapel where Jesus is portrayed with different kinds of representation. I found that sun worship influenced Christianity in the adoption of the orientation for prayer, in the adoption of Christmas. I'm sure that all of you know that Christmas was a pagan festivity. You don't have any Christmas in the first 3 centuries. The earliest Christian document mentioning Christmas comes to about 332, 333 in the Fifth Vatican, the calendar Philocolanus, which says that since that was the Natalis Solis Invicti, the birth of the invisible Son, Christian adopted it to celebrate, you know, the birth of Christ, the Son of Christ. After all, many of them came from a pagan background. They were exchanged to lighten up all of these trees and exchange gifts. And they wanted to retain the custom, so what the Christian leader did, listen, why don't we baptize it as a Christian festivity? Why don't we Christianize it? And this is what has happened. But more directly, I found that the very reason, the fundamental reason that was given for Sunday keeping by Justin Martyr, by in all of this document, the first and dominant reason given for Sunday keeping, you know what it is? It's not the resurrection. The resurrection usually is the second or third reason. The first reason that is given
By Justin Martyr, for example, in 150, is because that is the day in which the light was created. You see what they did? They read through the scripture trying to find the biblical reason for observing the day of the sun. They thought it was providential. They found it. Hey, the day of the sun is the first day. The first day of creation is the day when God created the light. So why don't we say that we observe the day of the sun? Because that memorializes the creation of the light. And then they added, because that was also the day on which the sun of righteousness arose. Obviously, if you want to celebrate what Jesus did on each day of creation, we can end up observing every day of creation, you know, God accomplished something. Well, there is much more to be said. My time is gone. I just want to conclude by saying that in the light of my investigation, the change from Sabbath to Sunday came about not by the authority of Christ, not by the authority of the apostle, not because of the desire to honor the resurrection of Jesus by means of the Eucharistic celebration, but as I have been trying to mention rather quickly today, as a result of this interplay of pagan, social, political factor, which made it expedient for Christians to adopt a different day of rest and worship, to show separation from the Jews, identification for the Roman. The question that comes down to us today is expediency a legitimate motive for changing a divine commandment? Did Jesus ever say, hey, if it's difficult to observe my commandment, don't suffer, just change it? Have you ever found that in your Bible? I don't find it in my Bible. But that's what has happened. I'm a church historian. I can testify that time and again, in the history of the Christian church, we find this expediency, this compromise, this attempt to avoid persecution, rejection, by culturally conditioning the Christian teaching and practices. My challenge to you and to me today, that God may help us to resist the pressure of cultural conformity. You know, let me just say something that is just coming in my mind, into my heart. Perhaps the Lord is speaking this to my mind just now. I never thought I was going to say this morning. The Sabbath is being challenged today in two different ways. In some churches, like you are experiencing now, is being challenged, you know, theologically and historically. But in other churches like mine, the Sabbath is challenged existentially, where there are some of the liberals who say, well, you know what, if you want to go out and buy food or buy services, or if you need to work on the Sabbath, that's not a big deal. And it's interesting to see the different ways in which the evil one tries to undermine this biblical institution. Do you know why? Why is so much Satan after the Sabbath? Do you know why? Because I believe the Sabbath is the sign of our commitment to God. You and I, if we take time out for God on the Sabbath, we take time out for God every day of the week. What we do on the Sabbath is an index of our relationship with the Savior. If you were to ask me, Brother Sam, call me Brother Sam, what's the difference between Sabbath keeping and Sunday keeping? It's the difference between two kinds of relationship with the Savior. Sunday keeping is lip type of service. You go to church for an hour. If you cannot make it on Sunday, make it on Saturday night. If you cannot make it Saturday night, now they talk about this fluctuating hour of worship. Just give an hour to the Lord and then seek for pleasure and profit. As long as you go to church, hang your clothes, and then you're finished. But the Sabbath is not lip type of service, but is the service reflected in the consecration of our total being. When you and I make time for God on the Sabbath by giving priority to God in our thinking and in our living on the Sabbath, we show in a tangible way that God really counts in our lives. Holy day for a holy people. Can you remember that? Observing a holy day constitutes a challenge to be a holy man, a holy woman, holy, consecrated to God. You remember what I said yesterday about this Jewish scholar who says the Sabbath has preserved the Jews more than the Jews have preserved the Sabbath. I believe that this can be said of our churches. The Sabbath will help us to retain our sense of identity and mission
much more than we are able to, you know, to preserve the Sabbath. And so may God help each one of us to come to understand and experience the Sabbath as the sign, the badge of our loyalty and commitment to God. May the Sabbath truly become for each one of us a day of joyful celebration of God's creative and redemptive love. A day when we take time out, we make ourselves free and available for God to experience more fully, more freely, the awareness of His presence, peace, and rest in our lives. This is my prayer for each one of us this morning. Thank you very much.